Hi, this is Catherine Morris with the Keystone Center. I'm going to pause for just a minute till we get some more of our participants on, but I did want to welcome you to the third in the series on assessing the impacts from clean energy. This webinar is going to be on assessing the jobs impact. So we'll get started in a minute. We've had a little bit of a lag between the people that are trying to join the audio. In the meantime, for those of you who have joined, you might want to download some of the presentation materials at www.epatechforum.org. You'll see that at the bottom of the agenda. And you can find there both the background materials as well as the presentation materials to follow along. We will, in about a couple of weeks, we'll also be able to post the recording for this so that you'll be able to, for those of you, I know I got a couple of messages for some of you who can't stay the whole time or are joining late. Again, that message is, or that website is www.epatechforum.org. Everybody is muted as you enter the room, so when you want to ask a question, we ask that you use the Q&A bar on the right-hand side. You have a control panel. Please feel free to type in your questions as the speakers are speaking, and we're going to pause after each of our speakers and allow them a chance to answer some of your clarifying questions. Then we'll save the bulk of the questions till the end of the three speakers or four speakers and have a little bit more discussion. So we have about 130 individuals joining us today, and I'll turn it over to Denise Mulholland at the EPA to get us started.
Thanks, Catherine. Well, hi, and thanks, everybody, for calling in to listen to the webinar, as well as those who are going to be speaking at today's webinar. I just wanted to welcome you today, and again, my name is Denise Mulholland, and I work for EPA's State and Local Climate and Energy Program. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to get us started before the three main speakers come on and give you an overview of how clean energy investments affect jobs. I'm going to describe at a high level the methods that are available and things to consider as you estimate the potential job effects of clean energy. And I'm going to pass the baton to the other three speakers who will describe what they have done to estimate jobs in states. So Catherine's going to get my slides up here ready to go, and then I'll just jump right in. Okay, so what do we mean by clean energy? So clean energy initiatives are those that encourage energy efficiency, renewable energy, or clean distributed generation. So when we're trying to decide, when policymakers are trying to decide what initiatives to choose, policymakers or analysts typically quantify the cost, but not necessarily the benefits of clean energy. And in doing so, this is underestimating the value of clean energy. And what kind of benefits do I mean? There are benefits to the environment and public health. There are benefits to the electricity system of clean energy, as well as benefits to the economy, including the creation of or support for jobs. So by quantifying these benefits, what you can do is beef up the benefit side of the benefit-cost equation so that you can more accurately and fully reflect both the costs and the benefits and then make decisions, you know, factoring in both of those aspects. Quantifying these benefits can also help you show how clean energy can achieve multiple goals, so maybe not just the initial perspective that you're looking for, the initial purpose that you're going for, but it can help you identify other ways that clean energy can achieve your goals, and that it can bolster support for clean energy initiatives. So let me move to the next slide. So how does clean energy affect the economy? Next slide, please. Investments in clean energy result in both costs and benefits, and what these costs and benefits do is they change the flow of goods, services, and income through the economy. Waiting for the slides here to catch up.
So, Margaret, if you could hand the controls over to us, and we'll pick it up from here.
Sorry, folks. So typically, I'll just keep talking while we're working on getting the slides. So I said that there's costs and benefits to clean energy, And we typically do see these costs reflected in the analyses. And what types of costs am I talking about? Well, there are program administrative costs that you need to think about when you're considering a program or a policy. And these are the costs that it takes the government or a utility or whoever to run the specific program that you're considering. There are also equipment purchase, operation, and maintenance costs. So what those are the costs that essentially your program is probably encouraging or inducing or requiring folks to invest in specific technology. So that's a cost that has to come from somewhere in somebody's pockets unless it's all their savings. In addition, there might be some decreased demand, revenue, and jobs from those companies that don't provide the clean energy technologies, or for fossil-based electricity companies, for example. So perhaps, you know, an electric utility that uses generally only fossil-based electricity or generates only that might see a decrease in their demand if there's a renewable portfolio standard put into place. So then that might then decrease their demand from their suppliers for inputs, and these types of effects can filter through the economy and potentially lead to job loss, which then reduces the amount of money that some workers might otherwise be spending in the economy on, you know, groceries, eating out, that sort of thing. So these are some of the costs that folks typically consider and that are important to consider when you're exploring or looking at a potential initiative for clean energy. But these only tell part of the story. So there are benefits that come from clean energy programs, both directly and indirectly, that are important to consider as you're looking at policies. So what type of benefits am I talking about? So we have increased demand, revenue, and jobs for those companies that do produce clean energy technologies and equipment and services. And then when they increase their demand, they have to produce new appliances or more appliances. It increases their demand from their suppliers to give them the inputs that they need to develop those products. And that can that can lead to jobs through the expansion of companies, and then that gives more people spending more money locally in their, you know, on their groceries and on their entertainment and that sort of thing. So it also, one of the economic benefits can also be lower energy and fuel costs that accrue to the consumers, companies, or utilities, whoever the target is of the program, based on the fact that they don't have to spend as much money on these fuels. We might see deferred costs for new power plants. Programs that can reduce the growth in energy demand might defer or put off the need to build new power plants, and then we don't have to expend that money today. We can put that off for 10, 20, 30 years, perhaps. We may also experience reduced health care costs and increased labor productivity because we now have better air and we have less illnesses and less people, you know, having to take days off of work and spend money at the hospitals. Essentially, we have more productive people who can spend money on other things. We also might see enhanced property values because with cleaner air and cleaner water, your communities or your state may be more desirable for people to want to, you know, live in and work in and play in. So considering both the costs and the benefits of an initiative will produce a comprehensive analysis that more accurately depicts the full value of clean energy to your area and will help you choose those options that will be most beneficial to you and match your priorities. So what are we missing? I think I just jumped ahead here. So what are we missing, though, in terms of job support if we exclude the benefits and where the money goes? What I'm trying to flip to next is a slide that will show, that will give you a visual illustration of what happens on the benefit side in terms of where the money goes and how it flows through the economy. And so what I want you to think about is imagine a government launches a rebate program. And so a variety of jobs are going to be supported along the way, as I'm going to indicate in yellow boxes. So you have the government, and they spend money, they hire consultants or marketers or auditors to help them run the program, and then they issue rebates to businesses, consumers, or to industry. And those folks then spend those rebates, they spend that money on investing in energy efficiency or renewable energy technology. And now to build that technology, you need inputs and you need labor. This is really a simplification, but it just gives you the idea. You need labor, you need folks to build the equipment, and you need inputs to the equipment. Maybe it's steel for windmills or for specific appliances. So with the folks that are now building your equipment, what do they do with their money? So they spend the money in the economy on mortgage and rent and entertainment and goods and services, big screen TVs, that sort of thing. And these expenses support jobs in those particular industries or businesses. Moving down to the steel or the input side of the equation, we have, you know, what do they need to get steel? Well, you need raw materials and you need labor and you need energy to make the steel to produce your product. And in order to get the raw materials out of the ground, say it's iron, you need people to do it and you need equipment to do it. So you've got jobs, maybe they're in mining, and you need capital equipment, which then requires you to spend money on steel and labor and energy. And so with respect to the energy, which you also see down here below it with steel, energy, in order to make the energy, you need to purchase fuels, and you need to purchase capital equipment. And the fuels, depending upon what you're using, may support jobs in mining and drilling, depending on whether it's coal or natural gas or what type of fuel you're using. So now, so this is sort of what happens from the investment in the specific technology, the clean energy technologies, how the money flows through. But you may also then see energy cost savings, particularly if it's an energy efficiency type of investment. And so with the energy cost savings, what that does is that increases disposable income for consumers, so now they can spend more money on goods and services that they'd like to spend their money on. And then for businesses, what they can do is they can either give it out, and they have new profits, they can give it out in dividends, they can hire more workers, or they can invest in more products and more output. So this is just a simple illustration of sort of what's represented on the benefits side of an investment that is important to consider as you're moving through and doing your analyses. So how can states estimate the job impacts of clean energy? Well, there are a range of approaches to estimate the jobs effects. There are basic methods, which are essentially screening approaches that give you a ballpark or a back-of-the-envelope estimate. And then there are sophisticated methods. These are static and dynamic modeling tools that can be proprietary or non-proprietary, but they generally are more sophisticated and more complicated, but they are available to states and local governments. Our speakers today are going to, they've used a variety of methods to conduct their analyses, and they're going to describe them shortly. And then I'm also going to direct you at the end of my presentation to a resource that you, where you can find out more information about the different types of methods that are available as well as tools that are available to you. So once you know what the tools and methods are, how do you pick among them? Well, there are many factors to consider, including time constraints. Is this, you know, is your analysis, do you need it tomorrow? Do you need it a year from now? Costs, how much does the model cost? How much money do you have? Data, data do you have available to you, and how much data does the approach need, as well as your internal staff expertise. You're not going to invest a lot of money in a big, sophisticated tool if you don't have the staff to run the model. And also, there's overall flexibility and applicability of the particular tool that you need to consider. So there, the table below, I'm not going to walk through it because you can do that certainly on your own, and there's more information at the resource that I will direct you to. But basically what it just shows you is that there are advantages and disadvantages with the different methods, and there are appropriate times to use each one. So those are all things that you should consider when you're choosing a method for estimating jobs. So things to consider in addition to those as you're moving forward with your analyses and you're thinking about and you're listening to the speakers that follow me. First, all methods involve predictions, inherent uncertainties, and numerous assumptions. These are not crystal balls. We do not have a crystal ball. So you just need to understand the different strengths and limitations of the approaches that you're using or that others are using and make sure that it's appropriate and that you, you use it appropriately. When you're planning an analysis, take a step back and think how the money is going to flow through the economy. So who's going to pay for the particular program? Where does that money come from? And then where does it go? These are all important questions that if you give somebody money, it has to come from somebody else. And if you take money from somebody, you have to give it to somebody somewhere in the economy. So you need to just think those things through and map them out. And there's some suggested questions to think about on my slides. You should also be very clear in your assumptions and your sources regarding both your costs and your benefits. What do your results include or not include? For example, are your jobs estimates net estimates or gross estimates? Are they in job years or in jobs? Is it a rough estimate or is it a pretty sophisticated analysis? Those are things that you should just be clear about when you're reporting your results. And then finally, I encourage you to invite experts to provide input to the analysis and your assumptions as well as to review your results because that will really help improve the credibility of your analysis as well as bolster support for it and the way that it's received. So with that, I want to just end with directing you to the resource that I mentioned to you, EPA's Assessing the Multiple Benefits of Clean Energy, a Resource for States. You can see the link on my slide on the screen right now. There's also a four-page backgrounder document on the Tech Forum website that Catherine mentioned where you can find more information about this document and receive all the links to it. And certainly you can feel free to follow up with me if you have any particular questions about it. And what I'd like to do now is ask you to hold off on any questions for me until the end of the call. You can send them in, but we won't answer them until the end of the call. And what I'd like to do now is turn it over to our next speaker and have him describe for you what he did in the state of Massachusetts to help them estimate the job impacts of their clean energy and climate plan. So with that, let me introduce Dr. Mark Breslow. Dr. Mark Breslow is the Director of Transportation and Buildings Policy with the Massachusetts Executive Office of Energy and Environmental Affairs. In 2010, he helped lead the team that developed the state's clean energy and climate plan for 2020, and he's now charged with coordinating the implementation of that plan. He's also currently the co-chair of the Climate Change Steering Committee of the Conference of New England Governors and Eastern Canadian Premiers. Before joining the administration of Governor Patrick in Massachusetts, Dr. Breslow was executive director of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. He has a PhD in economics from the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. And Dr. Breslow, I welcome you and turn the controls over to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate your having me on here. Just one second here. Okay, so hopefully we're going to bring up the presentation. It's going to show my screen somewhere. All right. Can someone say whether you can see my screen now?
We can see your screen.
All right, good. And let's
you might
switch
want
to slideshow, right. View. View slideshow. Okay, here we go. All right, so we're going to first go through some slides that show our estimates of energy costs in Massachusetts. This first slide here is the direct energy costs for households, basically just homes and personally owned automobiles. This is our estimate for 2008. And that's a fairly substantial cost, a little over $5,000 per household. And that's giving you the general sense of this is where the jobs are going to derive from largely, which is reducing people's energy costs. The next slide, these are now the costs for all forms of energy usage in the state, not just direct cost to households, but cost to business and institutions also. And you add them all up, it's all fuels plus the non-fuel costs of electricity. And the average in 2007 to 2009 was about $25 billion for the state, which comes out to, a bit over $4,000 per resident of the state, or you're talking a bit over $8,000 per household in the state. Then one analysis we did was just asking how much of this money leaves the state. Massachusetts is a state that has no energy production of our own and no refining of fuels, so this is somewhat more dramatic for us than it would be for other states since it's largely a loss. And what we found is that approximately 80% of the money related to energy expenditures leaves the state. It's paying either for fuels or for imported equipment, imported materials, or it's paying for the capital costs of constructing facilities, and you pay for those capital costs through either debt service to banks or other lenders or to payments to bondholders or payments to stockholders of companies. And since capital markets are nationwide or worldwide, virtually all the funds for capital costs or debt service can be assumed to leave the state. So what we found is that if you count all the costs of households, businesses, and institutions, the amount of money leaving the state is a bit over $8,000 a year per household in the state. Another way of looking at it is how much of our economy does that constitute, and it's a bit over 5% of the state's total economic output that's leaving the state just to pay for energy costs. Now, What do we do about that, and how do we propose to create jobs? Mass's energy and climate policies were greatly revamped in 2008. We passed several pieces of legislation. The first one was called the Green Communities Act, and one of the provisions of that legislation requires all electric and gas utilities in the state to fund all energy efficiency if it's less, to the degree that it's less expensive than providing new electric or gas supply. is this help thing on the box showing up on the right on other people's screens and blocking it, blocking part of the screen?
No, just on your screen.
Mine. Okay, fine.
If other people would like to minimize your control bar, there's a red arrow on the tab on the left-hand side, and that will minimize it and get out of the way. But that shouldn't be – yours isn't blocking anyone's mark.
Okay, good. So that was probably the most important part of the act. There were also a number of other parts, including ramping up our RPS requirement. A second law passed in 2008, the Global Warming Solutions Act, required us to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 10% to 25% below 1990 levels in 2020 and 80% in 2050. And the percentage between 10 and 25 was left for later decision, and that decision was based on an energy and climate plan that we developed over a couple of years. And at the end of that development process, at the end of 2010, we set the greenhouse gas reduction requirement at 25% for 2020. So between the laws and that plan, that determined the actions that we were going to take to get there. There we go. And on this next slide, what you see are some of the most of the largest items in our plan and how much money we expect them to save both households and consumers as of 2020. This is based on some very extensive analysis and figuring out implementation of bills, and it's also both state law and taking account of the impact of federal standards on our state. So you'll see for electric efficiency, which is based on that 2008 law, we're estimating a reduction in electric costs of about $2.5 billion in 2020. That's the largest item in our bill, and that's through very aggressive electric efficiency programs, which I think we now have the highest targets of any state in the country for that. For the year, just to give you some sense of the numbers, for the year 2012, which is the furthest out we're currently projecting in detail, we're estimating that the electric utilities, their target set by plan is to reduce energy sales by 2.4% through efficiency programs conducted during the year 2012. And then you've got natural gas efficiency, fuel oil efficiency, building codes, appliance and product standards, which are largely federal in California, vehicle efficiency standards, both for light duty and heavy duty. And then the last two policies are state policies, which are in our plan but not yet implemented, that we expect to have implemented well in advance of 2020. Altogether, we're expecting to save over $6 billion in 2020. Not in this list are renewables policies, for which the analysis is more complicated and the cost less certain. So for purposes of today's presentation, we were just looking at the policies that are clearly energy saving and cost saving. All right, so these are all dollar savings, and then you want to go from here to job gains, and then you need other methodology for doing that. There's several methods for that. Denise talked about it a little bit, and I'm just going to go over this very briefly. The simpler methods are what are called input-output models. The more complex ones are econometric models or other general equilibrium models. In our analysis, we and I use the RIMS 2 data from the U.S. Department of Commerce, which is the cheapest thing to do. I don't necessarily recommend doing this because you have to know how to use the data. Otherwise, you're just going to get the data and you don't really get the Department of Commerce is not set up to really explain to you how to use it. It's not a full piece of software that you manipulate. It's just data. Slightly more expensive but easier to use is the IMPLAN data system, which is doing something quite similar, but is a full piece of software. So either of those will work. It's relatively simple. If you do go to econometric methods, you're getting a more complex analysis. It's a somewhat fuller analysis, but it's also going to cost you more and take more time to use. I'm not sure I can explain well in a very brief period the difference between the two, but in simple terms, or just to give an example, if you're doing an input-output model and you implement a large-scale energy efficiency program, an input-output model is not going to tell you that if you implement this program and you put a lot of skilled electricians to work in making electric efficiency upgrades in both residential and commercial buildings, it's not going to tell you that you might tighten the labor market for electricians in your state, raise their prices, to some degree cause a shortage of electricians, and make it harder to implement the program and make it more expensive and therefore reduce your gains. An input-output model is not going to show you that kind of a price change to the labor market, whereas in theory anyway, an econometric model such as REMI will do that. For relatively small-scale changes to an economy, if what you're doing is only a small piece of the economy, you can probably live without those complexities. But they could have an effect, and the example I gave is one where what we're doing to our energy sector is large enough that you actually could get such an effect on the labor market. And you could also get costs on impacts like that on product markets or on materials. And I won't say any more about that for now. Now, why do you get an increase in jobs from cutting energy costs? Well, what people mostly think of is the direct job creation in the efficiency industries, in construction and consulting and manufacturing. And that's what's easiest to talk about. Those are the direct jobs. But in my calculations, and I think in most people's calculations, it's actually not the biggest impact. The bigger impact comes from keeping more money within your geographic region, whether that's a state or a city or a county or whatever you're looking at. And this holds more strongly if your energy is mostly imported. And what's happening is you're simply reducing both households' and businesses' expenses on energy that's coming from outside your area, and they can then take that money and use it on other things, and those other expenses will tend to be more locally based, whether you're spending money on house maintenance or medical care or buying food or education, whatever it is, it's almost assuredly more money staying in the state than on energy in most geographic areas. Also, efficiency programs, implementing the programs themselves, tends to be more labor intensive than energy supply costs. Depends on what you're doing. There's a variance there. So, for example, if you're installing insulation, that's more based on local labor costs than if you're putting new lighting technologies in a commercial building, in which more of the money is paying for the lighting of the light fixtures themselves than it is paying for the labor costs. And then also payments for capital costs, which are a higher portion of the cost for energy supply than for efficiency, largely go out of state. So this slide now gives our general estimate for how many jobs you get per dollar of spending of a particular type. And what you see is that for $1 million of spending, if you spend it, and this is specific to Massachusetts, since we have no energy supply of our own, if you spend it on an energy industry, you're getting in the neighborhood of one job per $1 million of spending. General household spending, which goes all over the place, some of it goes out of state, but most of it stays in state, that's for all the things that households put their incomes to, is getting you around 9 jobs per $1 million. So you're getting an increase of 8 jobs or a bit more for every dollar that you can shift from specific energy expenditures back to households. You get a similar effect for business. The calculation of both the household spending jobs multiplier and the average business spending multiplier are kind of complex. It's one of the more complex parts of doing this analysis. And they'll be different in every state. The data source.
I just want to give you a quick time check. We've got about 2 minutes.
Okay. Try to be quick here. These are the primary data sources used to construct these multipliers. And from doing all of that, when you combine the multiplier numbers with the total savings that we were estimating, both in transportation and in buildings, in which you're reducing the first three items are all buildings-related energy costs, and gasoline is obviously transportation. So when you combine our energy and transportation policies with these multipliers, you then get our job changes. As I said, most of it comes from reducing spending by households and businesses. Some comes from the efficiency programs themselves. And there are some job losses in the energy supply system. And interestingly, quite substantial job losses by cutting how much driving people do and the speed at which they drive to a little bit. You actually cut down on medical costs, insurance bills, and auto repairs, which have a lot of jobs in them. And these were the results that we got for Massachusetts for 2020, in which we estimated about 13,000 jobs total in due to our transportation policies and about 23,000 in buildings. And then a number in renewables, which I'm not really talking about today. So just from the efficiency policies, we were getting about 36,000 jobs in 2020. And these are jobs, not job years, in that we expect these to continue to the degree that it's based on saving energy, which is most of it. The saving energy is a permanent effect. To some degree, it's also based on the spending on efficiency industries, which will go on for some years. I don't know how many years it will go on, but we're not anticipating ending that after a year or two. If that was to terminate at some point, then these numbers would go down. And this is how you can reach me if you've got more questions.
Thanks a lot, Mark.
Sure.
Any questions, just clarifying questions before we move on to our next speaker? Please enter them into your control bar over on the right-hand side. We don't have any right now, Mark, but we're going to come back to you at the end of Carl's presentation. We may have some that come in at that point. I'm going to go ahead and introduce Carl Michael. He's our next speaker, and he's the program manager for the Energy Analysis Program at the New York State Energy Research and Development Authority, or NYSERDA. Michael's been there for, I have over 20 years, but then that information was probably about 5 or 6 years ago. So, Michael, you've probably been there almost 30 years by now. And he's really been in charge of the modeling and analysis for all the state energy planning, including the environmental modeling, economic modeling, forecasting activities. And in that position, he's covered everything from the modeling related to the REGI project, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative in New York, the Greenhouse Gas Task Force that New York launched, the Acid Deposition Reduction Program, the Clean Air Interstate Rules, just about everything. And he's going to talk today more about the work that he's been doing modeling the benefits under the Energy Smart Program, which is the energy efficiency and other programs funded by the Systems Benefits Charge in New York. So I'm going to go ahead and Carl, if you'll just let us know when you would like us to advance your slides, and I'll hand it over to you.
Okay, you can go ahead and advance the slide. As Denise said, yes, I've been doing this a long time. We'll just go with that. And I want to point out a fundamental difference in what I'm about to show you from what Mark talked about is we are looking back, whereas Mark was looking forward. So the analysis that we're showing you here is our best estimate through the year 2010 based on dollars that have been spent over the past 10 years. So these are based on data that was gathered to the best that we could for the programs that we've run over that time period. And so, of course, we expect these benefits to go forward, but I just understand that this is our best estimate of what has been accomplished to date. So first question, and Denise asked me to focus on this, well, why did we do this? Why do we want to estimate jobs? And the best answer I can come up with is, well, everybody wants to know. Anytime jobs just seem to be the one metric that people can hold in their hands, every politician is talking about creating jobs in a time of questionable economies and economies that are sometimes either stagnant or going backwards. Anytime anybody can come up with government policy that one can demonstrate with and be convincing that we indeed are creating jobs, doing good things for the economy, that is the best way of arguing that what we do is worthwhile. It's a good way of spending public funds. So that's why we do this, is people want to know how many jobs did you create. So we're able to do that a part way. The one thing anytime we talk about jobs, people want us to put names and addresses, and they want to say, you know, who are these people and where do they work and which company are they employed at? And we should always make it clear when we do this stuff while we are trying to make estimates on what we've already done. These are still models. These are still theoretical jobs. They're based on ratios of what happens in an economy and a given dollar expenditure for various things. So that's where we have to draw the line and say we believe the numbers that we put out here, but as soon as you go asking us, don't ask me for the names of the people and the companies that they work for. These are still estimates and these are still models, but nevertheless, we think pretty good estimates, and I'll always emphasize that we do everything on a very conservative basis because people love to tear this stuff apart. So I always hold that anything we estimate, it's on the low side, and there's a lot of things that jobs can be created out of work that we do that we're not counting here. So we're trying to count the concrete stuff. But increasingly over the last 10 years, there's just a lot of pressure if you work for the government to justify spending public money. So that's what this is all about. It's about showing that. We can spend public money and that we can get benefits that exceed the cost. So if you go to the next slide, I just want to talk real briefly about government programs. It all comes down to benefit-cost ratios. And that is the one universal metric that's used to measure programs. And I'm guessing that people have some familiarity. This is one of the things, we could talk for hours about how to calculate benefit cost ratios, but I just wanted to emphasize that the jobs calculation is part of the benefit cost ratio, and we start out with just calculating basic ratios based on resource benefits, and that's just a very simple energy savings, and so that's the most concrete kind of calculation. The jobs benefit is the second thing there, where it says non-energy impacts. So the point of showing benefit cost ratios is that the adder that's due to the jobs benefit is very substantial. So if you're looking at the total resource cost test, the jobs benefit, if we're looking at the total benefit cost ratio of a 2-to-1, the jobs benefits are on the order of between 25% and a third of that. So they are very, very substantial. So that's the only point, and we can talk. It's another whole discussion about how benefit cost ratios. But in terms of this universal measure, these jobs impacts really matter. We also do benefit cost ratios without the jobs impact because it's real important to know what are the contributing factors. And as you go up the scale here, the numbers become less and less. Certain, so but they're very important. So keep going to the next slide. Next slide. I'll keep talking if you're working on changing slide. There we go. The analysis I'm demonstrating here, it's based on our Energy Smart program, goes back to 1998. Our programs are run by, it's a charge on cents per kilowatt hour across the state. Not every kilowatt hour, but I'm not going to go into that, but it's most of the kilowatt hours that are sold in the state of New York are subject to a small adder that goes into the system benefit charge fund, gets used to run programs. The amount has escalated over time, but in recent years, it's been on the order of $175 million per year, and that all adds up to $1.4 billion that we've spent through year 2010. So that's the dollar amount on which the numbers I'm going to show you are based. So keep going. Switch to the next slide, and I'll keep talking. You've heard a model mentioned, a REMI model. That is the model that is used to come up with the numbers that I'm about to show you. REMI is a proprietary model that we do pay for, and there's some expense. Whether it's expensive or reasonable depends on that's all relative. But we've determined in New York that it's worth our while to spend the money because it's a way of demonstrating the value of what we do. So the advantage of using this REMI model compared to some of the other things, and Mark went into more detail about this than I'm there's a need for me to do right here, but there's an important distinction of REMI compared to some other kinds of analysis is that it's this dynamic capability as opposed to just a snapshot in time, whereby REMI allows the economy to make changes according to the changes that the concrete changes that you've input into the model, the energy savings. Anytime a dollar is spent in the economy, there's a ripple effect. It ripples through the economy to other sectors. And in the case of saving dollars for energy efficiency, particularly in the commercial sector, it causes, because of reducing operating costs, it causes additional dollars to be invested in those businesses. And those numbers don't stop with spending that dollar in the economy. There's some inertia to spending dollars in the economy that result from energy savings. And some of the slides I'll show you later show how some of that works. For purposes of this analysis, we assume that the dollar spending stops in year 2010. But the graphics that I'll show later on are going to show you how the benefits continue after 2010, even if you don't continue to spend dollars. Not that we're saying we won't continue to spend those dollars. We have every intent of continuing to spend those dollars, but the jobs estimates that I will be talking about here are jobs that are estimated to occur in 2010, and you can also see how the jobs continue in the future based on the dollars that are already spent, not assuming that dollars continue to be spent in the future. So next slide. Some of the things we're not counting here, I said we're being conservative. There's no health impacts measured here. We don't assume that energy prices go up in the future, and we don't assume the concept of market transformation. While we, it's one of our great goals, and what we do is try to transform markets. We only count the concrete benefits that have already occurred. There's no market transformation assumed. Keep going. It's real term. The term net jobs is absolutely critical to any analysis that one does. We're modeling both the positive things and the negative things. We're modeling the positive benefits of spending dollars on energy efficiency type equipment, lighting, motors, HVAC equipment. We're spending the bill savings get spent in the economy. And we're counting the fact that we've lowered the price of electricity by eliminating some generation on the margins. That's the price suppression. Those are the positive benefits. Okay, next slide. Absolutely critical to doing a fair and defensible analysis is count the negatives as well. And Denise started to talk about this. The important thing is this money did not come from nowhere. It did not drop out of the sky. In our case in New York, what we're doing is we are charging ratepayers more for the electricity, and so we are counting the that's a negative impact on the economy because consumers could have spent that money on other things. So we're choosing to take money away from ratepayers, spend it on energy efficiency programs, and so we're counting that a negative cost. The program participants are also spending some of their own money. And that's also money that could have been spent for something else. So we also count that as a negative. And there's also a negative impact on the energy industry because they're producing less product. So it's absolutely critical that you count both the positives and the negatives. And as we'll show, the positives outweigh the negatives, but the negatives are not trivial. This is the criticism that we often find with other analysis that we see done, is that only the positives are counted and the negatives are kind of ignored. So we would say that's just absolutely critical. So keep going.
Carl, just a time check. You've got about 5 minutes.
Okay. We're doing good. This slide is the result of the analysis that we've done here for our programs through 2010, and I just want to really emphasize with this that there's a lot of different ways of measuring jobs, and they get reported in a whole lot of different ways, and as Mark was careful to say, we're reporting jobs, not job years. This is a very important distinction, and it's a way of a job analysis often gets extrapolated to include job years, and the concept is that what we're saying is that through 2010, our programs have created about 4,000 net jobs, and what we're saying is there are 4,000 people working in 2010 that would not be working had our programs not occurred. And I also noticed that this graph shows the above the zero, those are the factors that are positive. The factors that are negative are shown below the line, and the black line shows the net impact when the negative is subtracted from the positive. And, you know, just to give you some idea of how numbers are often reported is the concept of job years, and that would mean that you would sum up all the jobs from 1999 to 2010 might report that our programs have created 24,000 jobs. Those numbers are in that box at the top. And I'm just pointing this out to show some ways of seeing through the rosiness of some analysis that are often held up for various entities to brag about programs. And again, we're trying to be very, very conservative. But if we wanted to count the job years through 2010, same number of dollars, same number of gigawatt hour savings in 2010, we could say that we've created 24,000 jobs. And if we were going to count the jobs that result from, because these jobs don't stop in 2010, even if we stop spending money, based on those energy savings will continue to result in job savings going out in time. So then we could say we created 70,000 jobs. So but we feel like pointing out measuring jobs for 2010 is the number that you can hold in your hand. You can understand what it is next to total employment, and we feel that's the most it's the best way of reporting. It's the most fair. It's the most honest, and it's the number that you can understand what it is. And otherwise, it sort of has the appearance that you're just throwing out some big numbers that sound really good, but when you compare them to the current employment, they're hard to hold your hand and understand what they mean. So that's the way we report numbers. Keep going forward. want to emphasize that in doing this analysis, we analyze each of these factors separately so that you can see what each factor is doing. And this is the impact of the spending on programs. You see the in the orange is what New York State spends. This is the ratepayer money collected from all the ratepayers, whether they participate or not. The blue is the spending of the customer's own money, that is the participants in the program. And notice that when the spending stops, there's actually a negative sort of a the economy trying to recollect itself. When you pull money out of an economy, there's some negative effects that are somewhat persistent. So keep going. I just want to show it's less important what each of these things are, but just the fact that we're analyzing each of these factors separately, and in the end aggregating them all to see what they all do together. And the energy savings, this is the one that's absolutely critical. Total result is most dependent on the energy savings. A lot of the other factors tend to kind of cancel each other out, but it's the energy savings that drive this analysis. And notice that 2010, we stopped spending money, but those energy savings remain because equipment is installed. It continues to operate, so you keep getting those benefits. And the reason it drops off, we've only assumed a 15-year life. And, again, that's one of our conservative assumptions because you like to think that you've transformed the market and people aren't going to go back to the old kind of equipment, but we're only counting the direct impacts of for 15 years. So next slide. This is the negatives of having taken money away from ratepayers to pay for these programs. So notice that after we stop taking money away from ratepayers, there's still some residual negative effects. So, again, we're being conservative, and we're trying to not paint an overly rosy picture here. We're trying to show what happens in an economy when you pull money out of the economy. It takes a while to recover. So we count that, too. Keep going. This is the slide that I want to end with, and this is the same slide that you saw 5 minutes ago. It's got one change to it. I just want to emphasize a kind of a universal one-size-fits-all metric that we've come up with because these numbers only reflect New York, but I wanted to give some idea of kind of unitizing these numbers. Anytime we create a new program, we don't necessarily go through this entire analysis to figure out what the impacts are. But we found that if we look at, because programs tend to be, the net impact tends to be the impact of the energy savings, a lot of those other factors, when you count the positive ones, when you count the negative ones, they roughly cancel each other out. And so what really drives the results is the energy savings, even when you count all the other things that you need to count. We've found that if in a given year you take the jobs that you've created and you divide it by the gigawatt hours that you've measured as savings, a rule of thumb estimate for what you might create in a program, if you know the number of gigawatt hours that savings that you've created with the dollars that you've spent, that roughly 1.1 net jobs per gigawatt hour. And, you know, daily we get calls from other people in our organization looking at some program design and how many jobs would I create if I did this. And rather than run an entire analysis, if you want to get some general idea directionally of what kind of job creation that you might see, we've found this number to be extremely useful. Looking either backwards or looking forwards, so that if you are talking about energy efficiency programs and you've done things like subject your programs to a resource cost test where you know that the benefits exceed the costs, I would submit that you could be relatively certain that your program is creating jobs, and I would suggest that the order of magnitude of the net jobs in a given year that you might create might be on the order of 1.1 net jobs per gigawatt hour. And I'm not saying go out and use that number to measure as a substitute for doing modeling for what it is you're doing, but if you're looking for an order of magnitude, we found this to be a useful number, and I expect a lot of different programs. If you know the number of gigawatt hours that that you're saving in a given year, that the jobs creation numbers would look something like that. So that concludes the formal part. I'm happy to answer lots of questions, and I would emphasize to anybody that I would be happy to discuss this in any more detail, answer more detailed question. That's over once lately, but I'm trying to give you some idea of the kind of analysis that we're doing here and which factors are important and how they work. So,
thanks. We do have some clarifying questions, and want to let our viewers know that we are posting the contact information for all the presenters up on the website so that you can get in touch with them afterwards if you do have follow-up questions. That's, again, www.epatechforum.org. Carl, one of the questions was regarding the distinction you started to make between job years and jobs. Could you just put a finer point on that? What is the difference between job years and absolute jobs?
If you create a job year is one person working for 1 year. If you create one job and that person works for 10 years, that could be called 10 job years. And it's extremely confusing in terms of reading reports of analyses that are done, because often these numbers are not distinguished, that you'll hear that X number of jobs was created, but in reality they're job years. And so we're trying to be very careful about saying that in 2010, we're talking about 4,000 jobs, and that is 4,000 people working in 2010 that would not be working if these certain programs had not occurred. But the fact
I think that helps. Thanks.
Yeah, okay.
One other question was that in your assumptions you mentioned that you hold the energy cost constant. Can you explain why that assumption holds?
We're just trying to be conservative. Most people believe that in general that energy prices would go up over time, and we're trying not to make analysis subject to differences in forecasts of what fuel prices might do. And if fuel prices go up in the future, that makes the number of job estimates that would go up, and so we're not counting that. It's just a way of being conservative. It would be being overly a high estimate if you believe that energy prices are going to go down, but we're just trying to take that out of the analysis of what the expectations for energy prices are.
Thanks. One other was whether or not you've looked at the distributional aspect of job gains and losses, that is, how they are distributed across the state.
Yes, we have, and that's part of the standard output of this model. And output for ME would be something like 80 different sectors. So, yes, those 4,000 jobs could be spread out across 80 different sectors. We just didn't show them here.
Okay. If I could go back to Mark. Mark, there were several questions. As soon as we moved on to Carl, a number of questions came in. One was a topic that Carl has brought up a couple times, the distinction between net and gross job gains. Did your analysis take into account the job losses? And is it so all the jobs that you were talking about were net of losses?
Yes, it is. It is net. So if you're looking – that's the general answer. And then, for example, with the efficiency programs, the savings being shown in 2020 are net dollar savings. So it's the savings to businesses and consumers net of the costs in the year 2020 of spending on the programs by both business and consumers and by the utility subsidies, which is what Carl was showing with some slightly different wording in his presentation.
Yeah. Thanks. That's helpful. And a follow-up question was similar to the one that was asked of Carl. Did you look at where the geographical distribution or the sector distribution of where the job losses occurred?
You said geographic.
Oh. Well, yeah, this is for Mark. I'm wondering if Mark, you said you looked at it, but I'm wondering if Mark did as well.
The job gains or losses? Or?
Well, I guess both. They did ask about losses, but it would be interesting to know if you looked at that aspect.
Right. Not in the kind of detail that he did, but in general, you can say that the major job gains are, well, a big part of them are in the efficiency industries themselves, and then another big part are simply in the ways that households in Massachusetts spend most of their money if they're not spending it on energy. So those are just the big spending sectors, which you can just think about how you spend your own money. It goes to housing and food distribution and healthcare and education and so on. And then the job losses come principally in narrow sectors where we're reducing costs. So that's energy supply and distribution to the extent that it exists in Massachusetts. So you're talking about retail distribution of fuels and electricity. And then, interestingly, as I said, on the transportation part, there were some fairly substantial reductions in expenses going to healthcare, auto repair, and insurance. Which brings up an interesting point that all spending should not be regarded as equal, in that there are ways of creating jobs with spending we like and ways that we don't like. So, for example, we could have lots more auto accidents and create lots more jobs dealing with the consequences of auto accidents. We probably don't think that's a good idea.
Okay. There are quite a few other questions that I hope we can get back to, but I want to go ahead and introduce our final speaker, Suzanne Teagan. Dr. Teagan is a senior policy analyst at the National Renewable Energy Lab, and she's been particularly focused on the economic and impacts of wind energy, including spending a year as the NREL liaison to the Department of Energy Wind Program in D.C. She also works on supply chain questions and renewable energy policy issues. So we've asked her to talk a little bit about a model that has been developed to estimate, I'm going to pronounce this incorrectly, I don't know if it's JEDI, but it's a model that she's developed, the job and economic impacts model. So I'll hand it over to you, and I see that your presentation's already up and running.
Thanks. And yes, you did pronounce it correctly. It has nothing to do with Star Wars, but it is pronounced JEDI for Jobs and Economic Development Impacts. And I'll just say up front that the JEDI model is based on past projects, on real projects that are on the ground. We do interviews with developers and others involved, but it estimates jobs and impacts for future projects. We created the JEDI model in 2004 to answer questions like these ones: how many jobs will be supported by wind in my community? So if a new wind farm is put in my community, you know, how many jobs will there be? What kinds of jobs will there be? How much money will stay in my state as opposed to go out of state? And so local and state decision makers were asking us these questions, and that's why we created the JEDI model. This is just a brief overview to point out that analyzing jobs and impacts is important. And, of course, today everyone wants to hear about jobs, like we've heard today already. But it's only one component of an overall analysis, and there are lots of other things to consider besides jobs and economic impact. Hopefully you wouldn't put in a power plant just based on job creation, especially with wind. You want to make sure there's a good resource and that kind of thing. The JEDI model is user-friendly. It's a very simple calculator. It's an input-output model. And this is a gross economic impact, so it's different from the other two that we've heard today. And the individual projects vary in key aspects and that affect economic development, state and local regions. So this is one example is if you have a local manufacturer in your state, then obviously your state is going to receive a much greater economic benefit than if you don't have local manufacturing. It's very important to acquire as much project-specific information as possible when you're running the JEDI model. The more accurate the inputs, of course, the better the outputs, which is true with any input-output model. And then there's just an email down below for questions if you have them, and I'll show you that one again. So who uses the JEDI model? People like you and I. This list is not exhaustive, but it just gives you an idea. We've performed state-level analyses for the Colorado Public Utility Commission, for the Michigan PSC, several governors' energy offices. We've done reports for different states, Texas, and we also help other people when they're running JEDI models in their states. We've done this in Illinois and elsewhere. You can download the JEDI model for free on this webpage, and if you don't feel like writing that all down, you can also just Google JEDI or search for JEDI at our site, nrel.gov. Today we're talking about the wind JEDI model, but we do have other models, as you can see there. We've got solar models, ethanol, coal, natural gas, marine and hydrokinetic, and more are coming. So we have a transmission model that I'm actually working on that's under development. A geothermal one is about to be online. Conventional hydropower and then different sized wind, and we're hoping to someday also get a nuclear one, but we don't have that yet. So after you run the JEDI model, and I'll go through in a second how that works, you'll see JEDI results in three different categories. And this has been talked about already today. They're in different analyses, they're called different things, but we call this a ripple effect. And our first category only includes labor. So your output from your results is going to include project development and on-site labor impact. And that's those jobs that you see right there and a few others. But here, if you're more of a visual learner, here are some sample jobs. The second category, so this one, like I said, just includes labor. The second category includes the turbine, the wind turbine, and all of the supply chain, as well as the jobs that go along with that. So we've got steel mill jobs, parts and services, all the equipment, all the parts there. It's been estimated that there are approximately 8,000 parts that go into a wind turbine, and that's counting little nuts and bolts as well. In this category, there are also property taxes, so financing, banking, and accounting, and all the jobs that go along with that, too. Your third category is called induced impacts, and we've heard different things from our two speakers before me, but these are, I can show you the slide, which is what I call my shiny, happy people slide. And some people don't count these, but I think these are actually really important impacts. This is money spent on local, in your locality when a new wind farm goes up in your area. And so there really is increased revenue to maybe not the flower shop, but you've got increased revenue to the hotels, increased revenue to the gas stations and the sandwich shops, definitely. So this is an important thing to count, and we count it in our induced impact category here. So this is, if you had downloaded the model, this is the screenshot that you would see. And I'll just go through really quick instructions on how to run the wind model. So this is a screenshot of the start page with high-level instructions on running the model. You just press start from this page to begin your model run. And then the model contains multipliers for analysis at the state level. And if you don't want to use your state as the starting point, you can also customize it to, it can be run at the county level or several counties. But usually the default is your state level, and it has state level multipliers for you. And our multipliers come from IMPLAN. You've already heard a little bit about REMI and IMPLAN and RIMS. And so ours, the backbone of the JEDI model is IMPLAN. This screenshot shows basic user inputs. And all you need to do to run a JEDI analysis is put in the state where the project will be located, the start year, and the project size. And then at this point, you can press the Go to Summary Impact button, and that will give you the default data. However, it would be a lot better if you choose No, where that little Y is right now. You can scroll down and choose No, and input your own project-specific data if you have it. And all of the white cells here and in the other ones that I'm about to show you indicate places where you can put in your own data. So you put in your own operations and maintenance costs. You put in your own the number of turbines or whatever it is. So these are the detailed user inputs. If you do have a lot of cost detail or other inputs, for example, there's an area here on the right for each line item where you can modify the local share percentage. And local share is a percentage of how much of the resource is coming from in-state. So if you have a blade manufacturer, for example, you can see there on row 34, way over to the right in your local share, you want to put 100% local if you're going to use blades that are manufactured in your state. And then you'll see that the result is a really huge benefit, economic benefit to your state. So I need to mention these caveats so people don't use the JEDI model to make investment decisions or consider them exact numbers. The JEDI model is a simple input-output model. It is better than a rule of thumb calculation, and it's based on real projects that are in the ground today. So it's, all the defaults are based on actual interviews with actual people. And let's see, it's not a precise forecast. It's an estimate of overall economic impacts, and they need your context. Like I said before, you know, if you've got the good inputs like cost information, then that's great to put in there. The size of the project, of course, is important. And we've already talked about gross or net versus net jobs, so I won't go into that very much, but just to say that this is a gross jobs model. So that means that when you get a result from this, it just means in your state, this is how many jobs will be due to that wind project. It doesn't mean these jobs, you know, aren't coming from somewhere else. It doesn't mean, you know, you can't tell whether the person who's employed now to install these blades was employed before or was unemployed or, you know, where they were employed or anything like that. You just know somebody in your state has a job because of this wind project, and it counts the number of those people who have jobs. The local sourcing levels, we've talked about that already a little bit. They have a very significant impact. We also count in full-time equivalent, and I think the other two studies did too. This just means if you have two people working half-time, that's counted as one job. And we've already heard about job years, so I won't go into that. In any model, you're trading off simplicity and understandability with precision. And so as you add more nuances to JEDI, it becomes harder for the outsider to comprehend. So given the purpose of JEDI to stay simple, there is a need to keep the model as transparent and accessible as possible. So it's a, like I said, it's a simple model, and it's an estimate. If you have something, you know, that you're running that you're going to base your decision on, you would want to use, you'd want to pay the, you know, whatever it is, tens of thousands of dollars, and use a more complex model, whether it be an econometric model or use REMI or something like that. So challenges to modeling renewables. When you're interested in tracking a more traditional power generation, maybe like a coal plant or something, there are standard industry codes that track coal plants and its parts and its workers, but renewable energy, like wind, doesn't have standard industry codes yet that are used by the Bureau of Economic Analysis, the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So we have to create these industry mixes, or industry libraries is what they're called in InPlan, to use in the JEDI model. For example, there's no button that you can click on to see how many jobs there are in the U.S. wind industry right now. You have to really sort of piece that together from different research that you do. So the rest of these things I think I've already mentioned. The next few slides are from some research conducted by a colleague of mine that I helped him with for the Wyoming Infrastructure Authority. They asked us to look at some scenarios for their state. The base case was 9,000 megawatts of new wind be installed over a period of time from 2012 to 2022, so for 10 years. And that's a lot of wind power, and Wyoming has a lot of wind potential, as well as 1,800 megawatts of natural gas and then multiple units of transmission. And this is just showing what their base case was, so that I just mentioned, that 9,000 megawatts of wind And this is kind of just showing some of the results that you can get from JEDI. So this shows the buildup of, as construction is kind of going on here, you can see the supply chain is building up. And then in 2022, when the construction stops, there are still jobs, but there aren't as many as during the construction cycle. This is kind of another way of looking at that. These, again, are jobs, not job years. So the axes here are different, but this is just to show, you can see the annual employment during construction kind of ramps up there. And then on the bottom, we have the installations of wind are increasing, so then that's why the jobs are increasing as well. So I'm showing this slide to remind people that it's so important to look at a range of assumptions and inputs and to run sensitivity analyses. You know, you always want to show low, medium, and high cases or something like that, just because no matter what model you're using, and Denise said this in the beginning, but no matter what model you're using, you're going to be wrong. you might be about right, but it's certainly not going to be precise to the number of exact jobs or anything like that. So it's always important to run sensitivity analyses. And this is from research that I did a long time ago in 2005, but I just actually added this slide because when Mark was talking, it just reminded me of this kind of flow into and out of your state. And so these numbers are not right anymore. This is from a long time ago. But the gist of this analysis shows that if you have a coal plant in Colorado, you can, you know, build that coal plant, and, you know, most of the money goes out of state. And, in fact, for each of these technologies, most of the money goes out of the state. But for wind, the greatest amount is going to stay in state, at least in this scenario at that time. So we'd have to rerun this for today. But this is an interesting graphic, I think, just to kind of show what goes in-state and what goes out-of-state. And I've said this before, but the JEDI model is state-based, and so it really only shows the jobs and the output, the overall economic output for your state. So you're not – if money goes out-of-state, you don't know whether that goes from Colorado to Wyoming for the coal. You don't know whether it goes to Iowa or whether it goes to Denmark or to China. You just know that it doesn't go in your state. And that's the same for the number of workers. It only shows you the number of workers that are in your state and out of your state. And if it's out of your state, you don't know where it is, whether it's domestic or not. But that's because this is primarily for people focused on statewide economic impacts. So if you're interested in this topic, I would encourage you to check out windpoweringamerica.gov. We have lots of reports on this and fact sheets and maps, and you have contact links there for if you're interested in doing work like this in your state or in your county. And we can also connect you with other state, the other people who've done this for their state or other people who've done these analyses for their county. And I think that's all I had. Yeah. So there's my contact information, and I'm happy to take questions. It sounds like we have a lot of them, so hopefully that wasn't too fast, but I tried to kind of flip through quickly.
Well, there's definitely a lot of interest in the other types of models you mentioned, particularly offshore wind. Do you have an estimated time of arrival for the development of that JEDI model?
I don't. We are seeking funding right now. We've been seeking funding for years for this from the Department of Energy, so contact your Department of Energy official or your congressperson and ask them to please fund NREL to do this work. We're really excited to do it. We have developers on board. We've got the industry saying, yes, we'll give you numbers. So people want to help, and they want to get this model out, and I promise I'll get it out as fast as I can, but we are not funded to do it right now.
One of the participants noticed also that you did not have energy efficiency, nuclear, or forest-based biomass on your list of potential developments for the model. Is that something that has been talked about or considered?
Yes, they all have been considered. So energy efficiency is something that I'm very interested in. It's actually something I worked on for my dissertation, the economic impacts of energy efficiency and jobs. So I'd be particularly interested in that, but we don't have funding to work on that one. Biomass, they are working on biopower, biomass, a model, and I think that there has been a little bit of complication with the funding for that as well, but I think that is coming. For the nuclear model, this is one I'd really like to get up on our website as well, but one, we don't have funding. Two, we don't have information. So it's because no nuclear plants have been built, it's hard to get information. It's easier for us to get information on the offshore wind projects, even though none of those have been built either, but it's much easier because those numbers are in the press, whereas if you try, I don't know if you've tried to get information from the nuclear industry, it's very tough to get their proprietary data. We, of course, don't give the proprietary data out, but we do need to know it for the defaults for our models. And we've actually had difficulty getting numbers for natural gas and coal models, too, but through kind of industry contacts, we work that out. So I'm hoping, as well as some of you are, that we can get those models up.
You mentioned that the JEDI model is very sensitive to how much of the manufacturing supply chain is in the state. So how do you go about finding out what percentage of the supply chain is in the state?
So we assume that nothing is built in state, because even if you have a wind manufacturing, so you have a tower manufacturer or something in your state, that doesn't mean that the wind project that you're looking at is going to use those towers. They could use them from out of state. So normally the default model is zero, because normally the answer is zero. If you are running the model in a place where there is wind manufacturing, and I guess maybe the person was asking how do they find out, there is an annual market report. The one for 2010 just came out. It's called the 2010 Wind Technologies Market Report. It was put out by the Department of Energy and actually done by Lawrence Berkeley Labs. It's a great report for information on wind power, and I helped them create a manufacturing map. It's a manufacturing facilities map for the U.S. in that report. So you can look it up. You can Google that 2010 Wind Technologies Report by Lawrence Berkeley Lab, and you should be able to see there's a page in there with a map, and it'll show whether your state has major wind power manufacturing. Now, your state could have wind power, or could have manufacturing that leads to wind power, you know, is in the supply chain, and then it might not be on there, but the major ones are on there. So that's one way. Otherwise, a lot of times your chambers of commerce or things like that will know whether industry in your state is involved in wind.
Thanks. We have a few more minutes, and I just have a couple of questions that I'd like to throw out to all of our speakers. One question asks whether or not there is a rule of thumb that similar to the one that Carl talked about in translating dollars invested into number of jobs. But is there a rule of thumb for also comparing gross jobs to net jobs, or translating the outputs of reports that might be reported in gross jobs into net jobs, or vice versa? Carl, you might be able to take that on in terms of how you handled gross and net in your particular rule of thumb that you're using.
Yeah, one could divide some numbers together and come up with such a thing, and that could be it could be done. We didn't just do that, but if I'm just eyeballing that graph, the gross is about the gross is about twice the net. And that, if you look at every year, if you look at, and I'm just looking at the stacked bar next to the black line. The gross is about twice the net. I hesitate to say, gee, that's one size fits all, but I can say it's probably not a. If you're just looking for order of magnitude, I don't know, Mark, if you'd comment on that, I don't know if you'd...
Yeah, I would say that probably sounds somewhat reasonable, that for energy efficiency programs would be different than renewables. For efficiency programs where the dominant effect is the energy savings to residents and businesses of the state, if you wanted to figure out a rule or a rule of thumb, what you'd want to look at is what's the benefit-cost ratio that somebody has computed for the efficiency programs. So if you're saving $2, if your benefit-cost ratio is 2 to 1, which means you're saving $2 for every dollar that you spend, then in general terms, your net benefits are probably something like half your gross benefits. The gross would be the total spending, and the net would be the half that's the savings. And so what Carl's numbers may be telling him, tell me if this is right. Well, no, your benefit-to-cost ratio was higher than 2, though, wasn't it, Carl?
Benefit-cost ratio was 2, yeah.
The benefit-cost ratio?
Yeah, when everything was included. That's total resource cost. That's includes the price of pressure. Yeah, so that would
right.
Be-
so I would say that the benefit-cost ratio and the gross-to-net jobs ratio more or less come out the same.
Yeah, if, I think rule of thumb. That's what you would expect.
Let me see if I can squeeze one more question in here before we close out. Early on, one of the participants asked about how or if at all opportunity costs of the energy efficiency investments, and this could apply to any of the renewable investments as well, are evaluated in the models. Do you take into account how either the job implications or how the dollars would otherwise be spent in your analysis?
Was that question directed to Suzanne? Or?
All three speakers. So, Suzanne, if you want to start and or have a response, that would be great.
Can you repeat the last part of the question? I heard the first.
Well, the question is, does your model in any way take into account the opportunity cost of the, in your case, of the investment in wind in the analysis? So how the dollars would otherwise have been spent and the job implications?
No. So this model just looks at if you put a wind project, you know, and usually they're not as big as the one that I showed, that 9,000 megawatts. Usually this is 100 or 200 megawatts or something on a farmer's land in a state, or that's typically what JEDI is used for. So we look at if you put a wind project in, what the jobs and economic impacts, including the land lease revenue to the farmer, and including the property tax benefit from the project developer, you know, for the local fire station and the roads or whatever that is. So it looks at all of those things, but it doesn't look at, you know, if we hadn't put in this wind farm, what could we have done with this money?
Carl or Mike, Mark, did you have any?
Well, I would say, I mean, for Carl and me, it's almost the same question as the gross versus net, that by definition, we're doing net jobs, which means we are asking where else the money would have gone. So, for an example, to be specific, if I'm looking at the jobs from federal fuel efficiency standards, I'm saying the loss or the opportunity cost in Massachusetts, well, or the opportunity cost in general, is you're spending less money on gasoline. For Massachusetts, very little of that money stays in the state. It's on the order of 10-12% that's going to retail distribution of gasoline. And that's the opportunity cost, would be the losses in that sector. And similarly for any other energy sector.
And I would say that those opportunity costs were calculated separately for residential customers and commercial industrial customers, and the opportunity cost on the residential side is calculated as that is, it's based on the dollars that were collected from ratepayers to pay for a program. So those are dollars that consumers did not have to spend for personal expenditures. And as a simplicity, we assume a standard basket of consumer goods that we would compare that to, recognizing that what gets spent or not spent on the margin is not exactly the same as that, but we don't know what it is. So we assume it's a standard average basket of consumer goods that is not purchased with the precise amount of dollars that are collected to for the state to spend on programs. So that's how the opportunity cost is calculated. It's done the same way for the dollars that the consumers spend on spend their own money for energy efficiency equipment. It's assumed that if they didn't spend it on energy efficiency equipment, they would have spent it on a standard basket of consumer goods. So.
Right. Well, thank you, Carl. And actually, this is Denise Mulholland again. I wanted to just take the time. It's the end of our call, and first I wanted to thank our speakers, Mark, Carl, and Suzanne, for giving very informative presentations, and certainly their contact information is up on the web. Please feel free to contact them or to contact myself if you have additional questions. There were several questions that we did not have time to answer, so please feel free to follow up with us. Thanks so much to the attendees. We are still at actually more than 120 people on the line and on the system, so I really appreciate the level of interest in this topic and the fact that so many folks have hung in with us till the end. There will be some survey questions as you exit the webinar that will help us better serve you and provide information about topics that are of interest to you as you move forward advancing clean energy efforts in your states and localities. And just a final heads up that our next monthly technical forum will be taking off, I'd say, the month of September. So look for an invitation to the next webinar sometime in the early fall. Okay, with that, thank you so much. I hope you all have a great day and a great rest of the summer. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And this does conclude today's conference call. You may now disconnect.